alert, intruder alert.
Welcome aboard, Captain. Fighter pilots needed in Sector Wars, play Astro Blaster.
R2 trying to increase the power.
Yahoo!
You're all clear, Kip.
Welcome back, friends, and thank you for joining us once again on the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast. Obviously, our audio hint from last week on the 1UP episode for Tron Deadly Discs did not fool anyone. You easily guessed that the subject of today's show is that legendary platformer from Nintendo. That's right, this episode is all about Donkey Kong. Donkey Kong is an important title to discuss, to say the least. In my opinion, besides Pong, Space Invaders, and Pac-Man, Donkey Kong is in the top 5 most important arcade games of all time. 38 years ago, on July 9th, Nintendo released what would become a behemoth of an arcade title to the arcades of Japan. At the time of this recording, we just passed that 38th anniversary celebration last week. Donkey Kong hit the States on the 31st of that month. And to say this game was popular is an understatement. Here's the surprising thing about the development of Donkey Kong. It wasn't actually Nintendo that created the game. Now, to be fair, it was Nintendo that produced the cabinets and did all the work for marketing and such. And it was most definitely designed by none other than Shigeru Miyamoto. Yes, the same co-designer as well as producer for a little-known game series called Super Mario Brothers and The Legend of Zelda, to name a few. When talking about Miyamoto, calling him legendary is really the only thing you can do. He was brought on board as an artist at Nintendo in 1977. Apparently, his father arranged a meeting with Nintendo's president, Hiroshi Yamauchi, to show off some of his toy designs. Obviously, Hiroshi was impressed enough to hire him as an apprentice in the planning department. Remember that Nintendo itself was founded in 1889. With interests in everything from cab services to manufacturing playing cards and novelty items, to name a few of their business ventures. Shigeru Miyamoto had a hand in designing the characters for 1979's Wild West multi-directional arcade shooter, Sheriff. Now then, here's where things get a little odd. It certainly looks like that at least in the early years of manufacturing arcade titles, Nintendo was taking popular games of the day and modifying them to create their own versions. 1979's Monkey Magic is basically a play on Atari's 1976 hit Breakout, which, of course, was a play off their own 1972 Pong. Nintendo also released in 1979 Space Fever, which was basically a reworking of Taito's Space Invaders from 1978. You get the idea. According to the GDRI page, that's the Game Developer Research Institute, it was Ikigami Tsushinki Company Limited that actually did the creating of possibly many of the early hits for Nintendo. Like Sheriff, Monkey Magic, Space Fever, and others. Actually, it has been said a contract was signed for Ikigami for 8 titles, all to be developed and created by the company, but sold as Nintendo as their own creation. To be fair, Ikigami also did this for Sega, for such games as Zaxxon and Congo Bongo. It was in 1980 when Radar Scope was released by Nintendo, a game that was co-developed by Miyamoto, but seems to have been created by Ikigami. Radar Scope was a fixed shooter that had a bit of Space Invaders and Galaxian to it, and it did quite well in its native country of Japan. It was Radar Scope that was picked to be the game that Nintendo of America would stake its claim with. The American branch was headed up by Minoru Arakawa, the son-in-law of Hiroshi Yamauchi, and set up stakes in Washington. For its first order, Nintendo of America would receive 3,000 Radar Scopes, and it just didn't catch on here in the States. Of those original 3,000 units, only 1,000 sold, which immediately put Nintendo of America on shaky ground, financially speaking. It's been said that Hiroshi made a call to his father-in-law asking for another chance, as well as a game that could be shipped to them, and they could put into those remaining radar scope cabinets. This is how Shigeru Miyamoto became involved in Donkey Kong. He was put in charge of the game design, but it would be Ikigami that would take the radar scope board design and craft Donkey Kong. I've also read that none other than Gunpei Yokoi, father of the Game Boy among many other products for Nintendo, supervised and offered assistance to Miyamoto. Shigeru was ahead of the curve. He wanted Donkey Kong to provide a story, which I believe I mentioned in the Mario Brothers episode of the podcast. Miyamoto originally envisioned Donkey Kong to be a game based on E.C. Sager's famous character Popeye. Obviously, Nintendo couldn't get the rights to the character, at least not until 1982. Although, having said that, Popeye was produced by Nintendo in 1981 as part of their awesome Game & Watch series of handheld LCD electronic games, which, I should add, was created by Gunpei Yokoi. While 1980's Pac-Man, of course, offered humorous little shorts in between some of the levels, Donkey Kong gave us a beginning of the story with everyone's favorite ape carrying a poor woman, later named Pauline, up to the top of a construction site, where the player, as a carpenter named Jumpman, who would of course later be named Mario, having to try and reach the top of each stage, avoiding the many pitfalls in his path. The names, by the way, appear to have been finalized by the time the North American flyers were distributed. Besides that intro, of course, the story was continued at the end of each stage, whether by Donkey Kong taking Pauline and climbing higher, or showing the fall of the big ape. Interestingly enough, some elements of Miyamoto and Gunpei Yokoi's didn't make it into the game, such as ramps or even a proposed seesaw mechanic that I assume would be a bit like the one used in the second stage of 1982's Popeye. The number of reworked radar scope boards, now running Donkey Kong, is a little vague. It's been reported that it was anywhere from 8,000 to 20,000. I certainly don't know the exact number, but you would think with 2,000 cabinets to be converted to Donkey Kong games, and no guarantee it would be a hit, the number would be somewhere in the middle, right? Anyway, what is known, though, is that one of the ROMs that can be located on the Japanese version is a message that reads, quote, "Congratulations! If you analyze difficult this program, we would teach you. Telephone Tokyo, Japan 044-244-2151, extension 304, System Design, Ikigami Sushinki Limited," end quote, which would lead credence to the fact that Ikigami definitely did the programming and creating of the circuit boards. Now, let me be clear, that does not diminish Shigeru Miyamoto's work on Donkey Kong, obviously, because it was his vision and design, with help from Gunpei, that made the arcade title an absolute juggernaut of a smash hit. There is still a little bit of history between Nintendo and Ikigami, and that is, the latter claimed that after the success of Donkey Kong, Nintendo copied and produced what is believed to be 80,000 additional printed circuit boards to keep up with the demand for the arcade game. Besides the obvious problem of Nintendo doing that, it's been said that there was no contract this time between Ikigami and Nintendo beyond providing the initial PCBs. The former claimed ownership of the source code itself. You can imagine that some bad blood began to form between the two companies, especially when it was reported that Nintendo reversed engineered Donkey Kong to be able to produce Donkey Kong Jr. Nintendo was hit with a 580 million yen lawsuit that actually didn't get solved until 1990, when a Japanese court determined that Ikigami did in fact own the original source code. The case was settled out of court, by the way. Obviously, Nintendo was able to produce Donkey Kong Jr. in 1982 through its Research and Development Team Number 1, as well as 1983's Mario Brothers and 1984's Donkey Kong 3. Ikigami definitely gave them the time to get up to snuff to start producing games on their own, but the bad blood between the two led the Ikigami Sushinki Company Limited to start helping Sega produce successful games of their own, like I mentioned a bit earlier, with Zaxxon and Congo Bongo, for example. Holy cow, friends! We've not had a game yet on this show that deserves such a dive into its history. Let's take a quick commercial break before jumping into my first encounter with Donkey Kong and its gameplay.
Wow! Mr. Arcade! Get him out of here!
He's playing Donkey Kong!
You like Donkey Kong, eh? Okay, big fella! It's
the official tabletop version of Donkey Kong, and it looks, plays, and sounds the same. It even has different screens as you get higher, and even more important, you can take Donkey Kong home.
Official Donkey Kong, the arcade game you can take home with you from Coleco.
All right. For what it might be worth, the first time I encountered Donkey Kong was not at my local Showbiz Pizza, although I certainly played it there as well. It still had a spot on the showcase row, as I've called it on past shows. That should demonstrate how popular it was that it could still stand shoulder to shoulder with new arrivals like Crystal Castles, Robotron 2084, Millipede, and so on. The first time I played Donkey Kong was at Games People Play, which I've talked about on previous podcasts. It was the first true arcade in Northwest Arkansas, and did brisk business until Showbiz Pizza moved into town. I have a really fond memory of playing Donkey Kong while my aunt and uncle cheered me on, friends. Here's the thing, though. I actually played Donkey Kong a couple of weeks earlier at a local IGA grocery store. Except, it wasn't Donkey Kong. It was Crazy Kong, which most would rightly assume is a bootleg of Donkey Kong. But the truth of the matter is, it was an officially licensed clone of the game, but was never meant to be released outside of Japan. The reason for its existence was Donkey Kong was just as big in Japan as in the States, and Nintendo couldn't keep up with the demand. So a game company called Falcon was hired to clone the title. The graphics themselves were redrawn and recolorized. It's possible that Crazy Kong earned its name due to running on altered Crazy Climber hardware. The intro is similar with altered theme music. The running sound of Jumpman is just the sound of the player moving Crazy Climber up the building. And when you jump in the game, you are actually hearing the grunt sound the giant ape made in 1980s Crazy Climber. The gameplay is basically the same, but I think it's the truth when I say that Donkey Kong definitely looks better overall. Like I just mentioned, Crazy Kong was never meant to be seen outside of Japan. But Falcon, I guess, decided they liked money and began exporting them overseas. Which apparently Nintendo did learn about and revoked their license to make copies of Donkey Kong in 1982. The genie was already out of the bottle, though, and that is how I was able to play Crazy Kong in my little hometown, not getting to actually play Donkey Kong until visiting that Games People Play. Donkey Kong tasks 1-2 players, taking alternate turns with helping the brave carpenter Mario rescue the beautiful Pauline from the clutches of Donkey Kong, who has taken the maiden fair to the top of a dangerous construction site. This is done with the aid of a 4-way joystick, allowing movement to the left and right, as well as up and down. While Mario isn't carrying any weapons on him, being a carpenter, that makes quite a bit of sense, thanks to the single jump button, he is able to attempt to avoid the likes of the wooden barrels that Donkey Kong rolls and the beams he hurls at the player, as well as the firefoxes and fireballs. Pressing the jump button will let Mario hop up in the air. But pressing right or left on the joystick when hitting the jump button will allow him to jump in that direction, for the purpose of hopefully hopping over the obstacles that will cost the player a life. Coming into contact with an enemy or obstacle will, of course, cost you a life. The same is true if he falls a distance greater than himself. With Donkey Kong being such an iconic game, I have no doubt that every one of you has played the game at least once or twice yourself. You know that saying you can just jump over most obstacles is easier said than done, especially depending on what stage you are playing. Normally, I would give you a breakdown on the types of foes you would encounter in the game, but to be honest, Donkey Kong is pretty simple in regards to enemies, so I'm just going to jump right into the 4 types of stages a player will encounter while playing the game. By the way, don't think I mean that I feel it's an easy game when I say its gameplay is simple. Nothing could be further from the truth. Donkey Kong is an absolutely challenging game. The first stage a player will encounter is the barrel stage. After Donkey Kong's intro cutscene and the challenge to the player asking how high can you get, Mario will appear near the bottom left of the barrel stage. Donkey Kong's weight has knocked the girders askew, and the player must reach Pauline at the top of the stage while ascending up the ladders that connect the girders, all the while avoiding the rolling wooden barrels that Donkey Kong continuously rolls down the girders. Once they reach the end of a girder, they will drop down to the next level until they reach the oil drum at the lower left corner of the stage. If a beam, or blue barrel as they are sometimes called, makes contact with that oil drum, it will spawn a fireball, up to a maximum of 5 on any stage. The fireballs are a seemingly sentient and angry foe. These deadly enemies can even climb up broken ladders to get at Mario. The barrels can roll down the ladders, and it seems they do so at the most inopportune times, crashing right on his head as he's trying to climb up the ladder himself. A player might find themselves having to scale up one of those broken ladders sometimes. Of course, Mario can only climb up them halfway. You would do this to avoid barrels rolling beneath you in a worst-case scenario, if you didn't have the time to make a successful jump. This will naturally open you up to getting smacked in the head by a barrel descending that same ladder. Interestingly enough, you will sometimes get points for leaping over an obstacle if you just happen to be near it. For example, if a barrel has dropped down a ladder and is near Mario, and you jump, you might actually get the points for leaping over it, even if it was in the opposite direction. Having said that, there are times that I've jumped over a barrel, and for some reason, it doesn't even give me any points. For the players to defend themselves with, there happen to be 2 hammers on the barrel stage. Jumping up, Mario will grab it and start to wield it, and it will destroy any barrel or fireball that the head of the hammer touches, earning some nice points in the process. However, having the hammer doesn't mean you can't still lose a life. Many, many times at the arcade, I've had a barrel just slide under the swing of the hammer and take me out, or conk me on the head as I stood too close to a ladder, taking out the barrel in front of me but missing the one that was above. While wielding the hammer, Mario won't be able to climb ladders or even jump. It's a great way to earn some points, but it's not 100% certain to keep you out of danger. One of my favorite tricks when using the hammer is to get near the edge of a girder, so that your hammer will cross over it, smashing the barrels above you. That hammer will only last around 11 seconds, and I've read it comes down twice for each second. By the way, that getting near the edge of the girder can work against you. If you happen to jump up, and Mario's head makes contact with a barrel overhead, you've just lost yourself a life. If you manage to reach the top of the stage, climbing up the ladder to stand next to Pauline, you will earn yourself a brief respite, and see a heart appear between the two, as well as earning whatever might be remaining of the bonus points. Starting at level 1, the bonus point timer will read 5,000. It will subtract 100 points for around every second of gameplay. If the bonus points timer reaches 0 before the player is able to reach Pauline, they will lose a life. Once Mario has reached her, you will watch as Donkey Kong begins to climb up to a higher spot on the construction site, tucking Pauline under his arm as we see Mario's heart get broken, literally. The levels are a collected group of stages. For example, for level 1, you will only have the ramp stage and rivet stage. Beginning with level 2, you will go through a ramp stage, elevator stage, then rivet stage. The bonus points timer will increase to 6,000 for level 2, 7,000 for level 3, and then 8,000 for level 4 through 21. With level 22, or the kill screen for Donkey Kong, you will receive 4,000 bonus points on your timer for this particular ramp stage, but you will lose a life after a few seconds of play no matter what, so it doesn't really matter. Jumping over a barrel will get you 100 points. Leaping over 2 barrels earns you 300 points, and if you can manage a leap over 3 barrels, it will earn you 500 points. I've read online that it actually shows 800 points, but it only gives you 500. This point scheme works with jumping over the fireballs on the barrel or ramp stage. If you smash a barrel with a hammer, you will earn 300 points. It appears to be random when using the hammer on the Firefoxes, or as I called them thanks to the 1982 Consumer Guide How to Win Video Games book, Will-O-the-Wisps, and, I kid you not, Flaming Chickens. Hey, in the glory days of the arcade, it was like a Wild West town in regards to getting accurate information. Anyway, taking the hammer to the Firefoxes will get you 300, 500, or 800 points. In fact, I think that goes for the beams, the fireballs, and cement pies in the game too. The next stage is the rivet stage. Donkey Kong has placed Pauline up on a girder, high on the fourth level of the construction site. The player must help Mario walk over the yellow rivets, holding the central row of girders in place. Removing one will get you a mere 100 points, but after the 8th rivet is removed, the player will get to see Donkey Kong plummet on his head, and Mario and Pauline are reunited, until the next level begins at a harder difficulty. There are two hammers on this stage for you to use against the Firefoxes. The randomness of how these foes move, though, are really stressful. So many times you'll be jumping over one and it changes direction suddenly, and Mario ends up landing in a ball of flame. At the arcade, I have seen many a player, both young and old, slap the side of the cabinet on this stage out of frustration. We then naturally ask them politely to not take out their frustration on the arcade cabinet. A thing to remember about the Firefoxes is they can travel up the ladders, and particularly in later stages, they can move at a good speed. They can also move down ladders in the stage, but only if Mario is a stage lower than they are. Another risk is the hole that removing the rivet leaves behind. If you get too close, you might find yourself falling to the level below and costing yourself a life. An important safety tip is that the Firefoxes only show up on the stage on the opposite side of the screen from Mario at the beginning of the stage. Fun fact, if you head all the way to the top of the stage and stand by the pole to the right of Donkey Kong, assuming a Firefox isn't laying claim to that spot, press the jump button. While in midair, press the joystick to the right. This way it doesn't register as you jumping to the right. You'll nab 100 points for every jump this way. Also in the rivet stage are three personal items of Pauline's that a player can pick up for bonus points. A purse, a hat, or an umbrella. And they will earn you 300 points for the level 1 stage, 500 points for the level 2, and then 800 points for every level after. The elevator stage is the one that really gives me the most problems. The player must traverse a series of broken girders, as well as attempt to cross two different elevators to get to the right side of the stage, which, as long as you time your jump, isn't all that difficult. There are, yet again, the three bonus items of Pauline. Although, to be fair, the purse in the upper right-hand corner of the stage isn't worth the hassle of trying to collect, in my opinion, as you have to deal with a fireball. No, the real threat in this stage is the springs that bounce across the top of the platform and fall to the bottom of the screen. When reaching the right-hand side of the stage, whether by taking the higher path or lower path courtesy of the second elevator, you will have to time your crossing to avoid having a spring land on your head. Worst of all is when you reach the upper platform, which takes up a little more than half the screen, you will need to get up the ladder to Pauline, all the while avoiding contact with those springs as they bounce across the platform. You must time your crossing of the platform and the mad dash to scale up that ladder to reach Pauline perfectly. You see, one spring will bounce a little further out than the other. Think of it as two types of springs. The one that falls closest to the ladder you climb up to reach the platform is when the player should attempt to dart up on said platform and cross over, stopping with Mario's toe touching the yellowish gold elevator machinery graphic. The next spring should leap over the player, and that's when you immediately head to rescue Pauline. Like with the ramp stage, as well as the conveyor belt stage, Mario and Pauline's reunion is short-lived, before Donkey Kong grabs her and climbs further up the construction site ladders. Which brings us to the conveyor belt stage. In this stage, the player must contend with three conveyor belts, located a level above the starting area and above some broken girders that are at least stationary. The last two conveyor belts are connected to a burning oil barrel spitting out fireballs. Remember, only up to five at a time can appear on a stage. The conveyor belts are problematic as they cover one side of the stage to the other, and being a conveyor belt, they are moving. So, they might start off moving to the left, but when Donkey Kong, at the top of the stage, reaches the left-hand side of the screen, they'll shift directions. On the belts are also an obstacle for the player to deal with. The cement pies, or cement tubs if you're going by that helpful 1982 How to Win video games book. The player can use the hammer on the first conveyor belt to take care of the cement pies for some easy points, or attempt to jump over them, hoping that Donkey Kong won't force a change in direction after you've hit the jump button. There is a second hammer on the left side of the middle of the stage, on those stationary girders. This is a good choice if the fireballs are giving you a problem, although you'll have to stay on the far left girder or risk falling off. To rescue Pauline, you need to either climb up to the far left or right conveyor belt. Avoid the fireballs and cement pies to scale up a ladder. But the ladder is continuously raising and retracting, so a player might find themselves rushing up to victory to only have the ladder lower itself from the prize. The good news, though, is All you have to do is reach the top. You don't need to get past the moving Donkey Kong to climb up next to Pauline. Friends, those are the four stages you'll tackle when playing Donkey Kong. The high score holder for Donkey Kong is Robbie Lakeman, with 1,247,700 points, followed closely by Wes Copeland, with 1,218,000 points. I bring that up because Wes Copeland is also the high score holder for Donkey Kong at the Arcadia Retrocade. He, in fact, pulled off a kill screen at the arcade. Although, sadly, I wasn't able to attend that event as my day job threw a monkey wrench into the plans. As usual.
And now, these messages.
Currency Barrel of Fun for breakfast. Donkey Kong cereal.
I'm gonna jump, you're gonna crunch. Here we go!
Donkey Kong!
More crunch!
Donkey Kong cereal!
Donkey Kong!
Donkey Kong cereal is part of this complete breakfast.
You love the crunch!
It's Donkey Kong, the arcade sensation, and now you can play it at home.
Hang on, sweetheart, I'm gonna save ya!
Now you can play Donkey Kong on your ColecoVision, Atari VCS, or Intellivision video game system. Donkey Kong has multiple screens, just like the arcade game.
You're not gonna stop me, you stupid ape!
Play Donkey Kong on your ColecoVision, Atari VCS, or Intellivision video game system.
Don't worry, darling! I'll save ya!
Help me!
The popularity of Donkey Kong meant it was going to be ported to the popular home consoles and computers of the day. Not just the Atari 2600 and Television and ColecoVision, but the Atari 7800, the Atari 400 and 800, XL and XE, the Commodore 64 and VIC-20, Apple II, the TI-99, as well as the Famicom and Famicom Disk System. It was also ported to the NES and Game Boy Advance, to name a few. The iconic game that Shigeru Miyamoto designed and helped create also found itself being licensed to t-shirts, that breakfast cereal, of course, board and card games, PVC collectible figurines, stickers, plush dolls, the Coleco tabletop handheld arcade game, coloring books, penny banks, to say nothing of being a segment along with Donkey Kong Jr. in CBS's wonderful Saturday Supercade animated series. Of course, with the arcade title's popularity, it was guaranteed to be featured on the exceptional 1982 album by Gary Garcia and Jerry Buckner. I'm talking about Pac-Man Fever, with the song Do the Donkey Kong. Arcade, we grabbed Donkey Kong on an early road trip. If I recall correctly, we picked up Time Pilot at the same time. It is given a spot on the showcase row. When you are walking past the windows of the arcade, you can see it from the sidewalk, along with Donkey Kong Jr., Donkey Kong 3, Mario Brothers, Dr. Mario, and Donkey Kong Pauline Edition. I think Donkey Kong is a tough game, although to be fair, I believe that Donkey Kong Jr. is actually harder. But besides Pac-Man, Donkey Kong is the game that you'll find always being played, and for good reason. It really is a legendary game, and it's a pretty great feeling to see young players come in and find it just as much fun as when I was introduced to it 38 years ago. Friends, I think that is about all I have to say about Donkey Kong. Although, I'm sure if I wanted to, I could keep this episode going, talking about all the tips and tricks to playing the game better, etc. As always, I want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join me in sharing our love of classic video games. I'm no expert, just a fan of such classic arcade titles, like yourself, and I enjoy talking about them. The Diary of an Arcade Employee is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and even Spotify. So if you have a moment, why not subscribe and help us get the word out on the show by leaving a review and some comments? Helping the podcast reach new listeners is always appreciated. You can find out more about the Arcadia Retrocade by visiting Facebook. Or for daily posts, you can check out the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast Facebook page. I share all manner of vintage arcade and home console fun multiple times a day. If you have any feedback or comments about the podcast, you can always reach me on Facebook or throw me an email at vicsage@retroist.com. You also can often find me posting videos of the arcade on my Instagram account, which is simply vicsage_. I, of course, want to thank the Retroist. For almost 10 years now, the Retroist has been a spot to share my love of all things retro. If you need to check out the best collection of retro-related articles and podcasts, why not hop on over to The Retroist? Now, have a token on me as we listen to a clip from the subject of the game I will be discussing on the next show. This has been a Retroist production. Thank you for listening, and have a better one. Goodbye.
End of line.